speech he delivered called on an alliance of Christian white people led by the United States. So it has been in the making, this notion of a holy war, Christian war. We also hear it a lot in Israel in a different context. Religion has never been a friend of women's rights. Religion has been the primary driver through which women's rights have been violated, and the violations have been justified in the name of a higher, a godly principle. So the comments that we are hearing right now, the incredible images that we have seen, should send shivers through the spine of every woman. And I think we cannot but escape wondering how can they then accuse the Iranian government of being led by God, because clearly that's also what they are trying to portray. It is a terrible moment for our global society. That is why Amnesty International is here at CSW, and we're here with a very clear message. We got to resist what is happening.
That is Agnès Callamard, Secretary General of Amnesty International. That does it for our show. On Friday and Saturday, I'll be in Mexico City at Festival Ambulante for two screenings of the new documentary about Democracy Now! Steal This Story, Please. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Spring is in the air. The world is getting ready for its annual revival of itself. Embrace Mother Nature on that journey with the help of psychedelic rock to ricochet you through time. Turn on and tune in Friday, March 13th at 8 p.m. with me, Katie Zip. Only on Double Groove. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, flooding is a danger across our area thanks to lots of rain. Despite having sanctuary policies, both Oregon and Washington are seeing a spike in ICE arrests. And a former governor warns Oregonians about a health care affordability crisis. Good evening. I'm Annette Newell. A flood watch is in effect until Friday evening for much of northwest Oregon. Runoff could cause flooding of rivers, creeks, streams, and flood-prone locations in urban areas. The Weather Service warns that landslides and debris flows are possible during this event. Pacific Northwest states and cities have pushed back against ICE efforts in a variety of ways. Both Oregon and Washington have sanctuary laws that restrict how much state or local police can help in federal immigration enforcement. So it might come as a surprise to learn both states recently saw a huge increase in federal immigration arrests. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more.
Even the blue states of Oregon and Washington showed soaring federal immigration arrest rates last year. In fact, new data released by the University of Washington Center for Human Rights show those arrests occurred at near record levels. The data reviewed Oregon, Washington, and Alaska immigration arrests from 2022 to 2025. Oregon saw major spikes in immigration arrests in the fall of 2025, with the greatest increases in the Portland metro area and Marion County. In Washington state, activity steadily increased throughout the year, with the largest growth in Clark, Yakima, and King counties. Between October and December, 1,174 people were detained in Oregon, and 951 were arrested in Washington state. Angelina Godoy, director of the University Center for Human Rights, said, quote, "In the Pacific Northwest, migrant communities have been reporting, and this data confirms, a dramatic uptick in enforcement, and with it, mounting concerns about serious rights abuses happening on our streets and in our workplaces," end quote. Non-custodial arrests, which include street arrests, at least partly drove the spike. In those cases, federal immigration officers use technology like license plate readers to determine a person's deportability. Researchers said, quote, "This process enabled them to make an arrest within as little as 10 minutes, including of many individuals for whom they had not previously obtained a warrant and about whom they made no individualized probable cause assessment of escape risk," end quote. The Department of Homeland Security did not respond to a request for comment. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Democratic Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley clashed with Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham this week in a Senate hearing called Sanctuary Cities, The Cost of Undermining Law and Order. Merkley is the top-ranking Democrat and Graham's the chair of a committee looking at the issue. Graham sharply criticized sanctuary cities.
You're never going to fix this if you have 200 cities that practice sanctuary policy because the illegal immigrant believes I get there and never leave. I've tried to work with Democrats to find a rational solution to our illegal immigration problem. We're not going to ignore 4 years of where Joe Biden obliterated our border. People came in from all over the world by tens of millions, flown into the interior of the country, and only God knows where they're at. So what we're going to do is be willing to reform ICE, try to fix problems that we've seen, but we're not going to give up on the idea that we need right wrongs here and deport people that present danger and try to regain control over our immigration system. To my Democratic colleagues, what is the answer to sanctuary cities? Is it to continue the policy? Is it to eliminate the policy? All of us say eliminate it. I think the public is with us by like 80%.
But Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley pushed back, defending states and cities like his own with sanctuary policies.
It's been a year since we've had a meeting of this budget committee. One of the big things that happened was a piece of legislation that Trump called his big, beautiful bill. But most of us consider it a big, ugly betrayal of the American citizen. What did it proceed to do? Slash nutrition for hungry children, gutted health care for millions of families, enormously increased the wealth of the already wealthiest, and it also massively increased the budget for ICE. Trump has turned ICE into secret police. I can't believe that we now have secret police in America, but we do. Show up in unmarked vans, unmarked uniforms, no judicial warrant, knock down doors without a judicial warrant, grab people, detain them, and often prevent them from having access and communication with families or lawyers. All of that's happening right now in America. We now have a secret police called ICE. And it's a tremendous black spot on our nation that this has happened under this administration. Freedom and privacy, laws, norms, and our Constitution all shredded. Heartbreakingly, 3 American citizens have been killed by ICE. Renee Good, Alex Preddy in Minnesota, and Ruben Ray Martinez in Texas. Now, ICE's budget has been increased by a factor of 7. The way that it operates has been dramatically changed from the norms of law and justice in a democratic republic to the strategy of secret police in an authoritarian regime. Wars come with enormous costs. We know that the wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan and Iraq were staggering in terms of blood and treasure. More than 7,000 Americans killed, more than 50,000 Americans injured, often life-altering injuries, more than $6 trillion of national treasure expended. America's at war, U.S. service members already killed, the Pentagon estimating $1 billion a day. But none of those are the topics of today's hearing. But we do have this topic that my colleague has pointed out, sanctuary cities. Sanctuary is a bit of a misnomer. Sanctuary states and cities are not places that are a safe haven where immigrants cannot be detained or deported. It refers to the decision that local police will serve as local police and not be commandeered to be assistant ICE agents. These policies are rooted in the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. And my colleagues across the aisle like to lean on states' rights. It's certainly a state right to refuse to have its local police commandeered to be assistant ICE agents. Assistants now to ICE operating as a secret police in the United States of America. So the idea that local police do local police work And ICE agents do ICE work is protected by our Constitution.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley. And Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray is also one of the leading voices demanding a de-escalation of ICE arrests and targeting of communities.
Funding has run out for DHS, and before passing any new funding, Democrats are insisting on putting in place reasonable accountability measures for ICE and Border Patrol after the horrific killings and overreach we have seen. But Republicans are so far refusing to do things as simple as requiring the masks to come off and requiring ICE to follow the same basic standards that local police follow every day when it comes to things like use of force or getting an actual judicial warrant before bashing someone's door in and dragging them away. Republicans would rather shut down DHS than pass a funding bill with basic oversight. I don't know how Republicans can look at what happened to Renee Good and Alex Pretty or see the videos of peaceful protesters getting tear gassed and tackled or see lawful observers getting their windows smashed and getting dragged out of their cars and think, this is fine, but I am not budging. We have a rogue agency and we need to rein it in. DHS officials even testified to Congress that filming their activities in public is perfectly legal, yet they threaten citizens with arrest and take their pictures for unknown purposes. Sometimes they spray them in the face point blank with pepper spray. Sometimes they gang tackle them and shoot them in the back 10 times. I want to make the problem just a bit more clear to Republicans in the Senate who are trying to sweep it under the rug by discussing some other ICE and Border Patrol shootings you may have missed. Because the painful reality is that in addition to the tragic killings of Alex Pretty and Renee Good, which rightfully got national attention, there are other cases where ICE and Border Patrol shot people with no clear cause and lied about it afterwards. We have to put an end to this alarming pattern.
17 Democrat-led states, including Oregon, Washington, and California, sued the Trump administration this week, challenging new race-based reporting requirements for universities targeting admissions, financial aid, and student performance data. The lawsuit objects to the new Admissions and Consumer Transparency Supplement Survey. It requires schools to provide years of admissions and student data broken down by race to ensure schools are not engaging in affirmative action. The blue states argue the requirements are costly and will be used as a tool by the administration to launch politically motivated investigations. Former Oregon Governor and Dr. John Kitzhaber is warning Oregonians about a health care crisis and an environment in which the costs are climbing while federal help is lessening. He told an audience at the Portland City Club.
For the last 30 years, Oregon has been at the forefront of national health policy innovation, driven consistently by the goal of better health, better care, and at a lower cost. That work has been animated, I think, by a willingness and the courage to challenge the underlying assumptions and structures of the current healthcare system, which I think is even more important now than it was maybe a few years ago. Over the last 50 years, health policy in this country has focused primarily on expanding access using public dollars. And the way we've done that, Medicare, Medicaid in 65, the Children's Health Plan in 1997, and then the Affordable Care Act in 2010. We've used public dollars to make healthcare less expensive for individuals, which is a good thing, but it's not the same as reducing the total cost of care. We have seen an increase in healthcare costs of over 10,000%. From $150 per person in 1965 to about $15,000 today. That makes healthcare increasingly unaffordable for individuals, for businesses, and for employers. The healthcare system depends largely on and increasingly on public resources. And as the constraints on public resources grow, the underpinnings of the healthcare system are starting to fall apart, creating a crisis in cost, but also a crisis in access. And at the intersection, the passage of House Resolution 1 last July is expected to take about $8 billion out of our healthcare system here in Oregon over the next three biennia. The intersection of escalating costs and declining federal resources has brought our system to an inflection point. But in my view, it also offers us a tremendous opportunity. No more money is going to magically appear to bail us out here. More money through the current system is actually not going to improve access, nor is it going to provide the long-term stability that hospitals and doctors and insurers are looking for. But it gives us the opportunity in this state to do what we've done so many times before, and that is come together as Oregonians and have an honest identification of those parties and factors that are driving medical inflation and develop a shared long-term strategy to move us through this crisis to a system that ensures that all of us have access to quality, affordable health care.
And Bruce Goldberg is a professor at the OHSU-PSU School of Public Health.
Healthcare has become increasingly complex. If you've ever tried to understand the explanation of benefits that you get, it's impossible. Your healthcare bill is impossible to understand. It's really difficult to get care in our healthcare system. And for those of us who provide care, it's really difficult to provide care. It's become incredibly complex. It's not a current crisis. We've had a smoldering chronic crisis of our healthcare system for decades. As I indicated, it's way too complex. As Governor Kitzhaber said, it's way too costly. Too many of us can't get the care that we need. And now, on top of that, we have the big, beautiful bill, although I know a number of you have other names for it. But let's talk for a minute about what that does. Huge piece of federal legislation passed this summer really impacts just about every aspect of life. It impacts Health and Human Services, it impacts taxation, defense spending, student loan, you name it. It's quite expansive what it does for Medicaid and to our state. And indeed, it really creates tremendous difficulties for us to continue to deliver health care to our most vulnerable populations. Medicaid, also here in Oregon, known as the Oregon Health Plan. Currently, the Medicaid program covers 1.4 million Oregonians. That's one in three of us get health coverage through the Oregon Health Plan. 57% of all kids in the state are on the Oregon Health Plan, half of all deliveries. Pretty substantive group of all of us. What HR 1, and this is a federal-state partnership. So the feds, interestingly enough, pay 60% of the bill, and we as a state pay about 40%. That makes them the majority partner. And although we call it the Oregon Health Plan, they set the rules and the funding. And indeed, it's the rules and the funding that are going to create tremendous difficulties for us. On the rule side, what HR 1 does is it requires 600,000 low-income adults who are currently on the Oregon Health Plan to document that they have 80 hours of employment or community engagement in a month. Community engagement defined as job seeking, job training, certain approved volunteer activities. So what's that going to mean? First off, it means we're going to have to invest as a state a lot of dollars in an already strained state budget to be able to track all of that. But more importantly, it means about 200,000 individuals are going to lose health care coverage. Why? They're going to make an error on a form. They're going to move and lose something in the mail. They're going to be late in handing something in. They may not be able to find a job and won't meet some of the criteria. And all of those individuals are still going to have health care needs. And now they're going to become the rank of the uninsured. We had been close to 97% of our state having health coverage. Now we're going to dip down. We're going to have 200,000 people who are going to lose health care coverage but still have health care needs. They're going to still end up in doctors and hospitals' offices and unable to pay, and those costs will be shifted to all of us.
Costs and government spending were also on the minds of people testifying to the U.S. Senate Finance Committee this week, where Oregon Senator Ron Wyden is the leading Democrat. He brought in Maya McGuinness, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, and Martha Gimbel, executive director of the Budget Lab at Yale.
Senator Cruz and Senator Scott calling for yet another big break, what looks to me like a handout to the ultra wealthy. This time it's hidden behind some industry jargon called indexing capital gains for inflation. And as I understand it, you can, in effect, erode the tax code, how much money we're talking about. Ms. Gimbel, how much would indexing capital gains for inflation cost? and how much of the benefit, I understand you've done some work in these precincts, so to speak, would go to ultra-wealthy taxpayers.
So indexing all capital gains to inflation would cost almost $1 trillion over the budget window. If you just limited it to new asset purchases, this figure would be a mere $170 billion. It's also quite regressive. The top 0.1% by income would see an average tax cut of about $350,000. Those in the bottom two quintiles would not benefit.
Okay. So lots of money. Is this something that the administration has the authority to do via executive action, or would this, in effect, require congressional action? In other words, what we normally think of as taxes, we get together, we bang the gavel, we do it here. Can you do this administratively by just executive action?
I am not a lawyer, and I do want to emphasize that, despite the fact that I am at Yale Law School. But the Supreme Court has repeatedly struck down similar levels of spending through administrative action.
Ms. McGinnis, is it appropriate, in your view, and you've been working in this area for a long time, for the administration to further erode the tax code through executive action?
I think there's two fundamental issues there. One, it is not appropriate to have further tax cuts or revenues that are not offset, and I would argue we shouldn't even do it if they are offset until we have a debt deal in place. We cannot afford to have this loss of revenue. When it comes to executive actions, I also am not a lawyer, and so we should follow the rule of the law. But it's clear that doing these kinds of huge budgetary actions, not through Congress, don't make sense. They are often illegal. They do not stick. We have been in a situation where policymaking has become kind of a pendulum of one party does it, the other party peels it back and forth. The fact that you don't have any certainty makes policymaking, business decisions, all these things terrible. And there is a lot of discussion right now about whether we need to be worrying about taxation of capital, how we should treat taxation of capital versus labor. And it is not at all clear that what we need to be doing is subsidizing the returns to capital right now, given the shifts in our economy. But from where I sit, the main point is that's a lot of revenue. We should not have offset tax cuts, period.
Thank you. And heaven forbid, what you've said is probably way too logical for Washington, D.C. But I just get the sense that something like this is not a close call. You bring it to the Congress of the United States and you offer your proposal. You take your prospects where you can. You see an opening to discuss it, and then you have a vote on it. But the idea of administratively, without the United States Congress stepping in, and the numbers that Ms. Gimbel has talked about, you were, to your credit, taking a rough estimate. But, you know, if we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, this is something that Congress ought to be debating.
A new report, The Scam Economy, finds cybercrime is costing people on the West Coast billions of dollars per year, much of it originating on Meta-owned platforms. Meanwhile, Meta is announcing new anti-scam features, and Congress is considering a bill to create a task force on cybercrime. Suzanne Potter has the story.
Online scams cost American consumers an estimated $119 billion each year and took more than $18 billion from Californians. Those are just two of the scary findings in The Scam Economy, a new report from the Consumer Federation of America. The FBI says Americans reported losing about $16.6 billion to online scams in 2024. But this study estimates that the true cost is seven times higher because only about 14% of cybercrimes are reported. Ben Winter with the Consumer Federation of America says those losses increased 33% from 2023.
Investment scams last year were by far the highest amount of money being lost. We also see a lot of business email compromise scams, some phishing scams, also tech support scams.
The report says 78% of the scams originate online and finds the majority spread through social media, especially Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, platforms owned by California-based Meta. On Wednesday, Meta announced that last year they removed more than 159 million scam ads and deleted almost 11 million Facebook and Instagram accounts linked to scam centers. The company says it's also testing new warnings to help people navigate suspicious accounts. Winters says social media companies aren't just the messengers, they are also profiting, pulling in significant ad revenue from scammers.
The Global Anti-Scam Alliance report in 2025 also noted that Gmail, Facebook, and Instagram were most frequently associated with scams. X, Snapchat, and Telegram were cited as the slowest to respond to scam reports.
The report encourages lawmakers to increase the liability of social media platforms, shut down data brokers, improve reporting mechanisms, and do more to regulate generative AI. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Ohio's Secretary of State is defending giving the Department of Justice voters' data. A preliminary military investigation finds it probably was the U.S. that struck an Iranian school. And Colorado Governor Jared Polis considers clemency for convicted election denier Tina Peters. For more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2026 Talks.
The federal government is bound by data privacy laws that are pretty ironclad. And if any federal official violated those data privacy laws, they would face criminal liability for doing so.
Republican Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose says he's confident in the security of the unredacted personal data of 8 million state voters he's turned over to the Department of Justice. Several Republican-run states cite privacy concerns when resisting administration demands for similar information. LaRose says he'll use the controversial Federal SAFE program, which tracks citizenship and public benefits, to stop non-citizen voting. But a 2024 audit run by LaRose himself found only one of every 16,000 voters registered in Ohio were non-citizens, probably registered by mistake. Meanwhile, Democratic Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes says the Trump administration is waging a full frontal assault on the state's mail-in voting system.
Created by Republicans, supported by Republicans, until one particular Republican lost.
Arizona officials are warning county recorders not to turn over unredacted voter files for an FBI investigation into what critics say are unfounded conspiracy theories about 2020. A preliminary Pentagon investigation found the U.S. likely made the late February missile strike on an Iranian elementary school that killed 175 people, mostly children. President Donald Trump blamed Iran for the attack, although the probe found the school was hit by a Tomahawk missile. Fox News correspondent Jennifer Griffin says Iran doesn't have Tomahawks.
And I think the president knows that. He just knows that this is certainly a mistake, a big mistake.
The FBI is warning California police agencies that Iran may send drones to hit targets in the state. Any drones would likely have to be smuggled in or launched by boats since they lack the range. A new NPR PBS Marist poll finds Americans are losing trust in election administration. Two out of three say they're confident their state and local governments will run fair and accurate midterms, but the rest expressed little or no confidence. That's up 10 percentage points from last year. Democrats mainly said they're concerned about voter suppression, while a majority of Republicans say they fear voter fraud. Colorado Democratic Governor Jared Polis says he'll hold off on deciding whether to grant former Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters clemency until a state court of appeals issues a ruling in her case. Peters was found guilty of providing a third party with unauthorized access to secure voting equipment in 2020. Kyle Giddings with the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition says giving her clemency after just 1 year in prison would set an unfortunate precedent.
I can't imagine what the impact would be on people that are currently incarcerated throughout Colorado.
I'm Catherine Carley.
Race and income are factors in access to nature being nearby, according to a new report. A digital divide abides for tribal communities, finds an Urban Institute study. And Denver donates 34 more bison to tribes and organizations. Here's Antonia Gonzalez with today's edition of National Native News.
A new report shows access to nearby nature in the U.S. is not equal, and the gap is closely tied to race and income. Researchers say indigenous communities are among those most affected. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
Communities of color are three times more likely than white communities to live in places with severe nature loss. Fewer parks, fewer trees, more pollution. That's thanks in part to resource extraction and the rapid development of natural spaces. Researchers say that's significant for tribal areas, where land is closely tied to cultural traditions and food systems. Raina Payan with Justice Outside, which co-produced the report, says losing nearby nature isn't just about scenery.
Nature deprivation isn't just about the aesthetics of who has access to big nature. It's also about who has access to clean air and clean water.
The report also highlights indigenous-led solutions. On the Navajo Nation, local groups are restoring native grasslands and wildlife habitat. In Alaska, Native organizations are protecting salmon streams and coastal ecosystems that support subsistence. Researchers say efforts grounded in indigenous stewardship could help close what they call the nation's growing nature gap. I'm Caleb Radel.
Reliable high-speed internet is still out of reach for many tribal communities. A new report highlights ongoing barriers to broadband access in Indian Country. Daniel Spalding reports.
The report from the Urban Institute says many indigenous communities lack reliable high-speed internet, especially in rural areas. Recent federal investments have helped expand broadband in some tribal communities, but gaps remain. Tommy Reininger is a co-author of the report.
In certain parts of the country, especially in Indian Country and a lot of rural communities, folks have a lot less access to high-speed broadband than other parts of the U.S.
The Urban Institute's Gabe Samuel says geography is one of the biggest challenges.
Because of the historic way where a lot of tribes are relocated, they are often located in more remote rural areas that are physically harder to access. It just compounds the challenge to accessing.
Reininger and Samuels both say allowing tribes to manage their own broadband infrastructure will be key to improving access. I'm Daniel Spalding.
American bison are a symbol of the West that might have vanished from the landscape entirely if not for conservation efforts. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the city of Denver donates bison from a long-established herd to tribes and nonprofits each year.
Snow powdered the 34 bison inside a pen while tribes blessed them. 11 went to the Navajo Nation. The rest were sent to the Northern Cheyenne Tribe, a Lakota nonprofit, Buffalo First in South Dakota, and the Denver-based Tall Bull Memorial Council. This keystone species once roamed the Great Plains, but faced the brink of extinction. In 1908, the Denver Zoo had only 18 animals left in captivity, but they would help form a herd near Golden, Colorado. The city has transferred more than 170 buffalo into tribal hands. I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Thanks so much for tuning in with us for this KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 12, 2026.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings, Josh Salem, and Nina Mayfair. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 100.